There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1048, June 17th, 2024. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say two in a row for Ferrari. FIA bending the rules for Antonelli. Dr. Marco's diary says, 9 a.m. July 9, he's meeting F1 Weekly. We shall explain very gladly. Back to you, Dr. Seuss of podcasting.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Ferrari takes back-to-back wins at Le Mans. Fernando says, Lance is the future of Aston Martin. Now get ready for the big one, folks. Renault Alpine want to leave Renault. How quickly they grow up. And this week's interviews, we're going to start off with Dan Wardman, former president of the CSRG, that would be Classic Sports Racing Group. We've got Japanese motorsports journalist Zenta Otaki. And your friend and mine, Otmar Szafnauer, former Aston Martin team principal. Plus, double bonus, we have the Rafa Report. And please, I must remind everyone that yes, we do need your contributions. Keep this program on the servers. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. Nas, welcome to the studio. How you been?
I am doing very good, sir. Thank you. Don't tell me you watched Le Mans for 24 hours.
No, and I actually set my DVR to record for 24 hours, naively not understanding that it's not capable of doing that. But when I got home after my long Citroën meet up in wine country with fellow tractionistes, I came home, it was still on, I enjoyed it, it was wonderful, and then on my Father's Day, Sunday morning, I turned on my recorded segment, and I had the last 4 hours, so I was a happy man, it was exciting. Porsche Penske accused everybody of sandbagging, which is wonderful, it's good to hear that sandbagging is everywhere. So, it was very intense, Ferrari made it by the hair on their chinny-chin-chin, but it was exciting.
Absolutely, sir. And sir, I have some very exciting news. I could not get a date with Mrs. Jones, but me and Dr. Marco, we have a thing going on July 9th. A few days ago, I got a ping at 1:30 in the morning, and it was Dr. Marco's assistant, Miss Vicky Katnick, doing a Pedro de la Rosa, and sending me a text saying, Dr. Marco will meet me at 9 a.m. on July 9th in his office in Graz, which is his hometown, and also the hometown of his school friend, Jochen Rindt. Now, this is a long time coming, as I first approached Dr. Marco a few years ago in Austin, and then came COVID. And at the Miami Grand Prix, I was just pure lucky that I was able to spot Dr. Marco walking without any Red Bull army or security people. And we had a brief chat and he said, you know, call my assistant Vicky to set up the meeting. So I am extremely thankful to him and Miss Vicky. And you know, Mr. Rogers, when something like this happened, which we are trying to do for a long time, it brings back all the memories, to borrow a phrase from the host. One of the earliest memories I have of Dr. Marco is somewhere in the early 70s. I went to downtown Karachi to an area where they used to sell old books and magazines, and I saw a full-size magazine. Remember like the old Life magazine, which was bigger than Newsweek and Time? You remember that size?
I do indeed.
And this magazine was from your Shangri-La French magazine called L'Automobile. And the cover story was the Le Mans 24 Hours. I don't remember exactly what year this magazine was. And I probably bought it maybe a year or two later. And I paid a fistful of rupees to grab this copy. And the image I remember most from that magazine is a photo of a young driver. It had photos of all the leading drivers in the race. But the one I remember was a photo of a driver who looked young, bright blue eyes and long blonde hair. And it was not Brendan Hartley, because the name listed was Dr. Helmut Marko. And here we are today. Like I said, you know, his story goes back to his school days when he was friend with Jochen Rindt. Dr. Marko won Le Mans, I believe it was 1971, in a Porsche with Heiss van Lennep. His racing career came to an end in the French Grand Prix of 1972 at Clermont-Ferrand, when a stone thrown from Emerson Fittipaldi's car hit and penetrated his visor, causing loss of one eye. Sort of a thing that happened to Massa in Hungary. And today he is a Red Bull advisor. His actual job description is judge, jury, and executioner of the Red Bull Junior program. And I will have a question or two for him about this. And as we all know, he is very efficient in his duties as young Polish driver Kasper Stuka found out today. More on that later. And Dr. Marko's day job is running a few high-end hotels in Graz. And his assistant asked me that if she should book a room for me. And I said, oh yes, please. This way I will make sure that I am at the interview appointment on time. So I am really looking forward to this opportunity. And sir, with that happy feeling, because today we have a fully loaded burrito with a side order of flan, shall we invite F1 Weekly familiar member and your fellow French car enthusiast, Mr. Dan Wardman, into the palatial studios?
Absolutely.
Dan, welcome to the crazy world of F1 Weekly. How are things in San Jose, California today?
Oh, pretty good. Nice weather and everything's good.
Clark tells me you are a longtime Formula One fan and a longtime F1 Weekly familiar member.
Yes, I've been a Formula One fan since the event that kicked it off was watching the Monaco Grand Prix on ABC in May of 1970 when Jochen Rindt passed Jack Brabham on the last corner of the last lap to win Monaco. And I just started getting into sports cars at that time. And there was something about that race and sports car racing in general that got me very excited. I had a Bug Eye Sprite at the time, and it turned into a lifelong interest and obsession, some would say.
Yes, it's a very famous race and a very famous past, 1973 Monaco. Now, I want to ask you a question. Looks like yes. Watkins Glen 1971, François Sauvez's first Grand Prix win. And this was, I believe, your first Formula One race. How did you get there from, I believe you were living in Connecticut then?
Yeah, I was undergraduate at University of Connecticut at that time. And I hitchhiked. It's about 350 miles.
Were there a lot of people going to the Glen back then?
It was quite popular back then. I couldn't tell you the size of the crowd, but it was quite busy. You know, I was in Watkins Glen quite a few years later, and I came across in a shop that had racing memorabilia, a copy of the program of that race, and including a couple of grandstand tickets that were used. And I don't know what it cost me to get in, but I couldn't afford a grandstand ticket, and grandstand tickets were $5. So it was a low budget thing for me. That's why I hitchhiked. I couldn't get there any other way. And I think there are a lot of people my age, you know, college students and that kind of thing, who were there and enjoying it very much. A very lot of drinking went on at Watkins Glen at that time, and other things as well.
Well, did you enjoy yourself to the max at the bog?
Well, you know, that was the first year that the bog got really kind of out of hand, is my understanding. It was an interesting thing to observe, but I did not partake myself. A couple of years later, because we were back there, and my wife was with me at that time in 73, the bog was really giant. Someone drove a bus into the middle of the swampy area and turned it on its side, and it was a very primal, you know, kind of primitive thing that was going on there. And then the following year, in 74, they did away with the bog completely. You couldn't bring any motorcycles, you know, inside the infield, and because that's kind of what started the bog, and they shut it right down. But so I was there for its heyday, I guess.
Now, going back to the race, the Grand Prix 1931, what is your everlasting memory of the race itself? What do you remember most?
It was all new to me at that point in time. But one of the things I remember very distinctly, that was when the Matras were running the V12 that had a very, very high-pitched exhaust note. And I found it very, very compelling, to see the cars running the track. And there was, at that time, it wasn't all just Cosworth Fords. It was the Matras, the Ferraris, the BRMs that were all running V12s. And I think the whole sound and experience of the track was an eye opener for me. It was the first motor race I ever went to, and it was great. One of the most kind of interesting things was that you, for 50 cents, you could get a ticket that would allow you to go into the paddock where the cars were kept. And it was so primitive, you know, it's sort of laughable today, but there was one long building. It was sort of like a Quonset hut, but not quite. And along the sides of the building facing out were roll-up garage doors. And every team that had two cars had two roll-up garage doors, and they would be in there. And in the center aisle of that building was where you could go as a spectator. And they had, you know, chain link fence around the individual team spaces. But you were right in there, right in the middle. There were drivers walking around. The mechanics would talk to you. It was great, the access that you could get back then. So I'd say the access and the sound.
And did you run into any drivers or racing personalities where you were able to do a hello, hi, or ask a question or two?
Well, no, I did see a lot of drivers, but I was pretty shy about asking anybody anything. I saw Mario and Jackie Eakes and James Hunt and Carlos Reutemann, Francois Sévert. They were all there. I mean, they were hanging out in the space around the cars. And it was interesting to see the different amounts of attention to detail you would see in the different paddock spaces. The Ferrari guy seemed to be working with a puddle of oil underneath the car the whole time. And it was sort of a Keystone Cops thing. And then you go over to the Penske side, and everything was meticulously clean, and they were super careful. Before they would take the cap off a brake master cylinder, they would wipe it off, you know, with three different clean cloths to make sure they get no contamination. So you could see the difference in the way the teams worked, and it was great.
You mentioned Francois Sévert. Sadly, he was killed in 1973 at Watkins Glen. Were you there on Saturday when he had his accident?
Yes, I was there we would go, in 73, I moved to upstate New York, and I was a graduate student at SUNY at Binghamton. I was living about 50 miles from the track, so we actually went up there on Wednesday and hung around the whole weekend. We were like the only ones there on Wednesday and Thursday. And so we got to see a lot. But yeah, we were there when Francois got killed on that Saturday. And we didn't, you know, as a member of the crowd, they didn't make a big PA announcement. They made a PA announcement that there was a crash, but not the severity of the crash. And it wasn't until the next day when Ken Terrell withdrew Jackie Stewart from the race, which was to be his last race before he retired and his 100th Grand Prix. That's when we found out that Francois Sévert had been killed, and that's why the Jackie Stewart retired from the race.
Yeah, I remember getting news of his death. I was 14 years old, and it really rocked the world for me. How did that affect you? Young guy at a race, and he won the very first race you were to. What was the effect on you?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to remember emotions from such a long time ago, but I was certainly, I become a student of Formula One at that time, and I'd read a lot of books about, you know, the history of Formula One and, you know, the Jimmy Clark era and Jimmy Clark's death and so forth. So I was in some ways conditioned to the idea of it, but the reality of it was something else again. And it was quite shocking. And to realize that this young guy who was my age at the time, I was like 23 or 24, that this guy, his life had ended in doing something that was a sport.
Now, you went to all the Formula One races at Long Beach. The 1977 race is very historical because it's the only Grand Prix in this country won by an American driver. Question, do you remember the reaction of the crowd when Mario Andretti took the lead from Jody Scheckter late in the race?
You know, my wife and I were talking about that race because we knew we'd be talking about it. I'd be talking about it with you today. And, you know, we both had the same recollection. We never yelled as loud and as long in our lives as we did at that moment. And it wasn't just us. It was everybody who was in the stands. Because, you know, the three drivers that were contesting for the win were you know, Jody Scheckter and Niki Lauda and Mario. They were all quite close together all the way through the race. It was an exciting race to watch. But, you know, Scheckter was maintaining his lead, and it didn't look like it was going to change because there had been such consistency in the closeness of the cars. And as I recall, there was some kind of a glitch in Scheckter's car, but it didn't matter. Mario came through, and my wife and I were both there. We were both huge Mario fans, and I'm a Lotus guy and have been for a very long time. And then it was the U.S. Grand Prix. So it was easily, even remains, the most exciting sporting event that I've ever partaken of. And I don't think I could talk for 3 or 4 days because I'd strain my voice so badly from yelling. And the same with my wife. So I think there was a lot of people who had that same experience. It was just remarkable.
Yeah, it's a great day for American motorsports. Okay, now, 1978, Carlos Reutemann won both the U.S. Grand Prix, East and West. And I love that beautiful design of the Ferrari 312 T3, even though you said you're a Lotus man. What do you say about the simplicity and beautiful beauty of that car, Ferrari 312 T3?
Well, you know, I had a theory at the time, and it seemed to me that the Ferrari epitomized this. As the cars got more aerodynamic and aerodynamics played a bigger part, it seemed that cars that kind of filled all the space that was available were the cars that were kind of using the most technology. And to me, the Ferrari 312, it's one of my three or four top favorite Formula One cars, the Lotus 79, the Lotus 49, the Ferrari, and the Brabham BT44 are all on my short list. And they're all, coincidentally, cars that I've made 1/12 scale models of because I like them so much. And so, yeah, it's a beautiful car and definitely one of my favorites. And even though, you know, ground effects tunnels kind of did away with that shape of car at Ferrari because you couldn't get the tunnel length the same as on the V8 engine cars. It still remains, a supercar as far as I'm concerned.
Now, across the pond, you have been to Grand Prix races at Silverstone and Barcelona. Your thoughts on those races and impression of the racing scene in Europe?
The Silverstone races, we were living in England at the time, and I was able to go to the 87 and 88 races. And they were quite a contrast between the two races. In the 87 race, that was a very famous race, remains on a lot of people's top 10 lists because of the incredible performance that Nigel Mansell put on in that race, where I think he broke the absolute track record at Silverstone 12 times in the last 20 laps to catch and pass his teammate Piquet and win within a lap, get into the lead within a lap and a half, I think, his victory. And I believe it was unprecedented. I was in general admission. I wasn't in a grandstand or anything like that. And so I was behind a big catch fence that was between me and the track. And the British fans, who are usually pretty, you know, decorum is important, they tore the fence down and flooded onto the track. And my understanding, and it was in there many, many, many thousands. And I don't think it had ever happened before at Silverstone in any race. So it was an incredible, reaction. You expect that kind of thing at Monza, but at Silverstone, it's a different story. And the other thing that was shocking, what they did at Silverstone, because the access in and out of the track was so bad, the roads were so narrow and crowded, especially at that time, that they had additional support races that ran after the Grand Prix was over. So people would sort of watch the support races and trickle out instead of all going for the doors at the same time. And in spite of the track being covered with people and, this crazy crowd, and they did the champagne and the national anthems and all that stuff, at the end of it all, the PA announcer comes on and says, "Everyone please return to their seats. We have some more motor races to put on." And sure enough, everybody climbed back over the broken fence and sat back down and watched the last couple of races of the day.
Interesting. What do you make of the 2024 season so far?
Well, I was certainly enthusiastic about Charles Leclerc's win at Monaco a week and a half ago. It was nice to see a race where Max wasn't on the pole for a change. And I'm hopeful with the win that Lando had in Miami as well, that maybe we'll see a little bit more variation this year. I'm certainly not betting against Max, but, we've been through these periods when Lewis was in charge and winning all the races, and Vettel and Schumacher. So it's to be expected, in McLaren years with Senna. It's to be expected. I think it's the cycle of Formula One motor racing. But I have to say, last year was pretty boring. And it's great to have some changes in the first half of the season. And hopefully we'll see more of it.
Lewis at Ferrari, will the prancing horse take him to championship number 8 or to sunset in SoCal?
Well, to my mind, he's already won championship number 8. And I think that what happened to him in 2021 was one of the worst things that's happened to an athlete that I can think of. I mean, it was just inexcusable in my mind, and I'm very frustrated about it. I have great respect for him, and I think he's sort of the greatest, if not the greatest driver ever, certainly in the modern era. And so I'm not a super fan, but I'm certainly respectful of him. And I would surely like him to see if he can get to the front of the grid and win some races and another championship with Ferrari. I kind of don't think it can happen in 1 year, but I hope I'm wrong. I'd love to see it happen. And, all these rumors about Adrian Newey going over to Ferrari, I'd love to see that happen too.
Yeah, I agree with you. On all points you have discussed here, including what happened in Abu Dhabi 2021. But man, I'll tell you, if Adrian Newey shows up and Lewis is there, then it becomes a matter of when they will win a championship. 2025 is not going to happen for anyone but Max. But let's see what time brings. Now, you and your wife are involved in historic racing. Can you tell us what kind of cars you have driven and what are the plans for this year?
Yes, I started historic racing 30 years ago, and I've been through a number of cars. My wife started about 15 years ago, and the same story with her. So I started out racing in a 1961 Elva Courier, which you may not be familiar with. It's a small two-seat sports car, fiberglass. It was quite a successful club racing car. In fact, Mark Donohue was an Elva Courier driver in his early days. And we had that car for a little while, and then I switched over to a Lotus Europa mid-engine Lotus, which I raced up until last year. And I've just now sold it. My wife, it's sort of an interesting story. I had been doing vintage racing for a while. I had the Lotus Europa. I had a Lotus Elan that I raced. And I was on a business trip in Belgium and saw this car that was for sale there. And I'd always been interested in small bore Le Mans cars, 1 liter, 1.3 liter, 1.5 liter cars that were very aerodynamic, and we're all about, you know, trying to get the last ounce of performance out of a small engine and the best top speed and the most sound possible. And so I saw this car called a René Bonnet that was for sale locally in Brussels, and I had some free time, so I went and looked at the car, and I thought, you know, it's a beautiful car, very, very shapely car, and it turns out they came out in 62, and it's the first mid-engine production sports car, so it's got some, you know, interesting history because of that. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, we ended up buying the car and shipping it back to California, and it became my wife's vintage racing car. And she has been she raced it for 15 or 16 years. She's since retired from racing a few years ago. Had great success with it, won the Rolex Cup at the Monterey Historics in the car, and, you know, had a lot of fun with it. We still have it, and I'm not sure whether we're going to race it again or not. If it's going to be raced, it'll be by me. I've had a bit of a mishap earlier this season. I broke my leg, and I'm still recovering from that, so I can't even get in the car right now, let alone drive it. So whether we get it on the track again or not, you know, remains to be seen. And we also raced Formula Fords. We both had a vintage Formula Four. I had a 1970 Winkelmann WDF2, and she had a Royale RP16. We had great fun with that. It's sort of a Walter Mitty thing, imagining you're there on the grid with a bunch of other Formula cars. It's sort of like F1, but, you know, it's a long way different, I'll tell you. But we really enjoyed it. It's been a great thing for both of us. And my friends and the camaraderie I experienced with vintage racing, it's been a central part of our lives.
Good. And I hope you are back on your feet and back in your racing car soon. Will you be at the what was known as Monterey Historics at Laguna Seca this year?
No, we won't be there this year. We're going to be actually in Denmark. Our son and his family live in Denmark. We're going to be over there for much of the summer this summer.
Now, I understand you are friends with one of our interview subjects, Mr. Howden Ganley. How is he doing these days? And is he still residing in Black Hawk, Northern California, or in England now?
You know, I haven't seen him for a couple of years, and he was good friends with a guy named Locke de Bretville, who was the president of CSRG, which is the vintage racing group I run with. And Howden was in the habit of coming to all our races. And that's how I got to know him. He came and hung out with my wife and I, and we talked racing. And he was very interested in the René Bonnet. And he has an article, a byline in one of the New Zealand racing magazines, and he wrote an article and took pictures of our car for publication in this New Zealand magazine. So we got to be fairly friendly with him, and he hasn't been coming to races for quite a long time. And what I've heard, so I haven't seen him for a long time, what I've heard from Locke is that he's back in England and still be very involved with the BRDC and that stuff. But I think he may have a new girlfriend or something. I don't know the details. But he hasn't been around much lately.
Now, you were at IBM for a while. I remember many years ago there was a Porsche at Le Mans which had big blue IBM on the side of it. Did you ever try to talk to your marketing people about doing something in Formula One when you were at IBM?
Interestingly enough, I did. And I saw that car. I think it was 95 that it won Le Mans? I think so. Porsche GT1. But anyway, whatever year it was, I happened to be at the Goodwood Festival of Speed, which was the weekend after Le Mans. And they had the car at Goodwood in full Le Mans grime and dirt, you know, all over the car. And I poked around. I was an executive at IBM myself, so I had some contacts, and I tried to find out why, you know, this car was sponsored by IBM and why other, you know, we couldn't get into other forms of racing. Well, it turns out IBM had a policy at that time that they would not advertise in anything that was considered a blood sport. In other words, one in which you could get injured. And in fact, found out that IBM sponsorship of that car was done locally by IBM Germany guys and not IBM corporate guys. And they got in a lot of trouble.
Really?
So that's the story. That's my understanding, yes. And they got in a lot of trouble. I even heard that, I'm not clear whether they lost their jobs or not, but it never happened again, put it that way.
Wow. Now, IBM also stood for I've Been Moved. Did they move you from Cottle Road to Poughkeepsie or Endicott or overseas for that matter? I remember back in the day, IBM used to make typewriters in Hungary. Did they ever post you to Budapest?
No, I actually have the opposite story to the normal story of I've Been Moved with IBM. I did have an assignment in England for IBM, and I lived outside London for a couple of years while we were working over there. My whole family moved there, of course, and so I did that. But other than that, I started working as an intern at the IBM Silicon Valley Laboratories in South San Jose in 1978, and I retired from IBM in that same building in 2015. The difference was at the time that I retired, I was in charge of the whole site and the mainframe database business in IBM. So I kind of went from the bottom to the top over the course of those 35 years.
Now, we have three races in the US of A these days. Your take on that? And are you planning to attend any Formula One race this year?
So, I'm a little bit worried, frankly. It seemed like the hype was cranked down a little bit at Miami this year. I'm happy that Las Vegas didn't turn into a fiasco after that manhole cover incident. But what I'm afraid of is that it does seem to be the case that Drive to Survive has pumped up the numbers in Formula One races, not just in the United States, but around the world. And I think that part of the reason that we have three Grand Prix in the United States now is because of the promotion that was done through the Netflix special. And so what I'm afraid of is that is it a fad to be interested in Formula One, or is it something that will have staying power? It's great to see that all the venues getting sold out. It's great for the promoters and for the teams and everything else. But I just wonder if it will stick, because I don't get the sense that the people who are following Formula One now and are interested in the personalities of the drivers and so forth, they have the kind of interest and intention that will hold for the longer term. So I'm cautiously optimistic, but I'm a bit wary too that this could be a short-term phenomena. And you're asking about my plans. The last time I went to a race was Montreal in 2011, and I've been tempted to go down to Austin because it's not too hard to get there. But to some degree, my own racing and the activities around it have kept me busy. I'm sort of undecided. I don't have any plans to attend any races this year, but I'm not rolling out for next year.
Now, one thing that is not sticking in Formula One, unfortunately, is Michael Andretti's attempt to get a slot. What is your take on that?
Well, Naz, I listened to your interview of Mario on this topic, and I just find it unconscionable that why would, of all the people to not allow to break into Formula One, Mario Andretti would seem to be the most, the most universally appealing new entrant you could possibly hope for. And bringing with him the might of General Motors, I mean, I can understand why teams are worried that they, move him down a notch in the totem pole, but it can't be anything but good for Formula One to have the Andretti name associated with it. So I find it baffling, and I certainly hope that the problems can be overcome and the cars can be on the track.
Now, I greatly appreciate your time, sir. Last question is, how and when did you discover the F1 Weekly Sanatorium?
I found out directly from Clark. He and I are both French car guys, and I know you knew that about Clark, but probably not about me. And I'm a Citroën owner, and I have three French cars right now. And I had a Renault Caravelle, which Clark used to have, and I had an R5 the same time he had an R5. So we hit it off on French cars. And he mentioned, sort of off the cuff, oh, by the way, I have this podcast that I do on Formula One. So I checked it out and immediately started listening. I've been listening ever since. But it's only been 2 or 3 years since we had that initial conversation about it.
Great. We thank you so much for your time, and have a wonderful rest of the weekend. And, you know, next time I'm in San Jose, we'll get together for some Chinese or...
That sounds good. You know, we actually did meet once. You and Clark were going to the Monterey Historics, and you had parked. He was in his traction, and you guys had parked behind the grandstand near the start-finish line. And I was riding my bike over to the paddock because I was camping with my motorhome and racing that weekend at Monterey. And I knew Clark from before, and we met, he introduced you, but it was just a 2-minute thing. But we did actually see each other at one point in time.
Oh, that's very interesting. I do remember meeting some people very briefly with Clark a few times at Laguna Seca on these historic events. So, maybe one of them was you. That's very interesting. But we will definitely hook up for and grab a bite if you have time.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, that would be really great. You know, any time you're in San Jose, just let me know.
Dan, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. We'll see you on the road. Nasser?
My thanks to Dan also. Really enjoyed our conversation and quite a background on the IBM sponsorship at Le Mans. And sir, speaking of Le Mans, shall we take an Arizona iced tea break before we open the Motorsports Mondial file?
Good thinking, Nass. I'm heading for Pabst Blue Ribbon, so we'll be back after this brief message.
Imagine for a moment that you're in the gay 90s, headed for an evening at the best spot in town.
Bartender, 3 more blue ribbons.
Imagine you're here to enjoy the great premium beer of the day, Pabst Blue Ribbon.
More Pabst.
Pabst was brewed for people who really liked beer.
3 more blue ribbons. Bartender.
This was the time Pabst was the beer. And now that you've imagined what the gay 90s were like, you know what our beer is all about. Good old-time flavor. Original Pabst Blue Ribbon beer is still brewed today the old-time premium way by the first of the great Milwaukee brewers.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial, with the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir. And before we talk about Le Mans, a question for you. You know, FIA has now reduced, or basically they're going to allow, bend their own rules about drivers must be 18 years old. So they're going to bend the rule because Kimi has shown this and that, and he will be able to race this year. Some people are huffing and puffing because of all the, you know, custer stand they took, not allowing Colton Herta. What's your take on this, sir?
Track limits, sir. It's all about track limits. Yeah, it's unfair. It's uncouth. And you know what? It also looks very un-American. Right, Mr. Andretti?
Nothing surprises me from FIA and FOM these days. They can't even agree on with each other, but when it's convenient, they do. And when it's not, then they just, you know, shooting from the hip, basically.
There's a certain billionaire in the paddock who speaks with an Austrian accent. He had a lot to say about this behind closed doors.
Who would that be?
Well, his code name is Bob Newhart.
Well, okay, now we move on to Le Mans. You know, some years ago I was at Laguna Seca and I met this British journalist in the video room, and he says to me, Le Mans is a French race for British fans to be won by a German manufacturer. Well, they and the team Penske missed out this year. 2 in a row for Ferrari, winning drivers in the beautiful Ferrari 499P were Antonio Fuoco, Miguel Molina, and Nicholas Nielsen. Toyota came in second with Jose Maria Lopez. He was told more than once in the closing minutes as he was charging like a bat from Buenos Aires to bring the car home in second. And of course, Pechito wanted to win, and he was told, we need the points. His teammates were Kamui Kobayashi and the Dutch Logan Sargeant, meaning Nick de Vries. And that was Leisinger of the day. Third was another Ferrari, putting Italian Jesus Antonio Giovinazzi on the podium. Penske's racing pole-winning Porsche, by the way, this was pole number 19 for Porsche at Le Mans. They came in fourth, and the guy who put it on fourth was your fellow Français, Kevin Estre. And Zak Brown's United Autosports team won the LMP2 class. One of the drivers is from Palo Alto, California, Nolan Siegel. I will put him as one of the top three young American talents in racing today. And he's racing in Indy next, and we interviewed him last year, I believe. Now, this is interesting. In the Why Am I Not Surprised folder from both Le Mans and Formula One, we find both Alpine cars DNF at Le Mans. And as you mentioned, according to experienced and respected journalist Joe Sayward in his blog, and this has now been picked up by other medias, Alpine is looking for an engine supplier for their Formula One team. The question I have, if Aston Martin can be powered by Honda, anything is possible in Formula One. Perhaps Christian Horner can supply Alpine with engines from Red Bull powertrain and give them a taste of their own medicine. How did that grab you, sir, this information?
Totally hilarious, but in the end, it's really not that surprising in this global automotive world. For instance, and I think this is a very good example, and a lot of Toyota Supra enthusiasts were disappointed, but yes, the new Toyota Supra that you can go and buy at the dealer is a very great little car, high performance, and under the skin, it's actually a BMW, so I've seen everything. Why not? And Alpines will probably be powered by Briggs and Stratton very soon.
I thought that's who the power supplier right now is, the way they are going. But you know what is interesting? And I know I'm putting two very distant strings together here. You remember Monsieur Cyril Abitbol used to work at Renault and Schloss Alpine or whatever. You remember that, right?
Of course.
Guess where he is working now? And there are reports that his new employer is trying to get into Formula One.
I'm telling you, Nasser, I'm on the edge. I have the pulse of the nation. Yes, Hyundai is ready to come in to the sport. And they'll probably be competitive. Who knows? And you know what? This could be good news for Carlos Sainz Jr. because he still doesn't have a drive.
Yeah, but I think that Alpine, you know, if they can get a competitive engine for some, you know, by FIA regulations, one of the teams has to supply. So most likely it will be the team that has the least number of customer people who are buying their engines. So this is very interesting. I think they should just work out some sort of a deal with Michael Andretti and have it as Andretti Alpine with a Cadillac engine. It will be win-win-win for everybody. What say you?
You know, that's not a bad idea because Cadillac was always very well liked in the old days in France. It was always very well respected.
And it would be nothing better than the BWT sponsorship, you know, will come with it. And it will be a team Aretha Franklin, Pink Cadillac.
Exactly. And Cadillac has raced in Le Mans going way back.
Absolutely. And speaking of Carlos Sainz, some people are saying that he has basically shot himself in the foot by waiting for an opening at Red Bull, which going to Red Bull for any young driver as long as Max is there is career suicide, okay, or waiting for a slot at Mercedes, and now he has limited choices. Where do you think he will go?
I'm not sure. It's looking like slim pickings, even the pundits are saying he could be out of luck and doing the Dakar rally with Papa.
Papa has changed teams too. He will be at Dakar with Ford.
And, you know, they have a better idea.
Yes, and we will see how it works. I really think, as we stand now, I don't see Williams doing anything regardless of what James Vowles says, okay? I really think he should go with Audi. They will give him a long-term contract. They will pay him a lot of money. And it's not easy for any new engine manufacturer to come and win. So I don't think he's going to win in the 26-27 season. But when you have if you're not winning, but you have millions of dollars coming in every month, you are happy. And you will even sing praises of somebody like Lance Stroll. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. And there's always that small possibility that it could be a Braun festival, a 2009 phenomenon where Audi comes out of the box, competitive, blowing everybody out of the water, and you would be the hero. So you have to have a positive attitude.
Oh, you know what? I have an idea for Audi. Audi powered by Honda.
There's a limit.
Yes, exactly. No, I think nobody's going to win in their first year among the new companies, you know, Ford and Red Bull powertrains and Audi. But you need to have a good future for yourself, and I think that's what Audi offers. And, sir, before we move from Formula One to Junior Formula, shall we have a listen to Mr. Otmar Szafnauer and his plans for the future?
Otmar, welcome to the studio.
Okay, folks, I'm here with Mr. Otmar Szafnauer. Sir, good to see you again. First question is, when are we going to see you back in Formula One?
Oh, that's a good question. My gardening leave is over in mid-August, so I can work for another team from September onwards. But, you know, there's 10 teams and 10 team principals, so I'll see if I can help anybody with their program. But I'm starting to talk to people now.
Based on your comment when you left Aston Martin, how many popes are required in a team to be successful?
Exactly. You can only have one pope, really. So, but, you know, now it seems like it's getting more fashionable to have a CEO and a team principal. So, you know, I can see that happening.
Now we have three sold-out fantastic races in the U.S., Miami, Vegas, and Texas. Do you think there is room for Ford? And if so, where would you like to see that happen?
Yeah, you know, I've always personally said that, you know, if we have races, it's a lot easier if they're actually destination events. You know, like Vegas is a destination, Miami's a destination. Austin, I love the city. So to me, yes, I think four is an appropriate number for a country that has, you know, 300 plus million people, and in a country where Formula One is getting more and more popular, and in a country where everyone loves sports. So yeah, we can have four. You know, for me, New York would be a destination.
What about your hometown, Detroit? Would you call that a destination city?
Well, you know, I have a soft spot for Detroit, so I would say yes, but it's not about me. It's about the fans considering it a destination.
Well, we have a lot of upheaval going on in Formula One. Lewis going to Ferrari. Was that a shocker for you?
Yeah, I mean, I understand it. I was surprised that it was announced so early. But, you know, perhaps it was announced early because it was going to leak anyway. So, look, I was surprised at the announcement, but when I look at it, I understand why.
Okay, now, will he get championship number 8 in a red car before Alonso gets number 3 in a green car? What say you?
Well, that's a good question. You know, both are great drivers for good teams, but if I was a betting man, I would bet on Lewis number 8 in a red car.
Okay, now motor racing is all about performance. Your fellow American, Mr. Logan Sargeant, he's under a lot of pressure. If you were a team owner, would you keep him on?
I would definitely keep him on for the rest of this year just to see if there's improvement and what kind of trajectory he's on. I wouldn't change him now.
And Adrian Newey going to, we don't know where. Where do you think he will end up?
I have no idea. And, you know, that I can't guess. It's probably best you ask Adrian.
Okay, your family background is from Romania. You've done a tremendous job coming through the system. Of all the things and the teams you have worked with, what is proud moments for you that stand out?
You know, I've never... Look, for me, it's all about winning. And, you know, probably one of my best moments is being the team principal at Racing Point when Sergio Perez went from dead last because he was hit by Leclerc to winning the race in Bahrain. So that has to be a standout.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time.
So my thanks to Mr. Otmar Safnauer for giving me a few minutes of his time, and hopefully I will see him someplace soon. Okay, Mr. Rogers, now Poland is again suffering from a Stuka dive bomb. The Marco Machete has come down hard. I think this just came out today. After only four rounds of this season's Formula 3 series, the victim is the Polish driver Kasper Stuka. Now, I'll tell you, last year, early part, I may have heard his name, but I had no idea who he was. But this is what happened. In the second half of the Italian Formula 4 championship, he was over 100 points behind. I think it was like 123 points behind championship leader Arvid Lindblad, who is sponsored by, even now, by Red Bull. So it was in the bag for Arvid. Kasper then became the winning ghost and basically dominated the second half of the championship and took it away from Lindblad. Based on this, Dr. Marco hired him gladly. Now the Marco Machete has come into action. Stuka only scored points at Imola. He is 19th at this point in the championship. Four rounds mean eight races, okay? So being 19th in the championship after eight races is definitely not what the doctor ordered. No wonder Dr. Marco has peppered him with, "Your services are no longer required." The driver said on his social media that his season will continue thanks to support from his sponsor, and we wish him all the best. Any thoughts on this, Senor?
Well, it's typical. You got to take it. But you would think that he'd give him a second chance, at least into the second part of the season, simulating or emulating what happened in F4. But Dr. Marco is not a very patient man, as you shall see, Nasser. You better have your questions in order, or it's going to be chop chop.
No, I have my questions in order, and I had requested 20 minutes with him. I said about 20 minutes to his assistant, Vicky. So I'm going to cover his whole racing career from growing up with Jochen Rindt. And, you know, he even had a team in Indy Racing League. So I'm going to ask him how much he enjoyed the $1 hot dog at Martinsville if he ever went there. So it should be fun. We'll see how it works out. Okay, now, sir, shall we go back to Formula One for because I want to ask you your favorite question. Who's going to win the Spanish Grand Prix behind Fernando Alonso?
El machismo, he's ready to go. Well, we're back in Max territory, I believe. And Frédéric Vasseur better have Ferrari ready and going, because Leclerc needs a win here to stay in this championship fight, to keep it all exciting, so it's going to be tough, but Ferrari needs to perform, especially after winning at 24 Heures du Mans.
Yeah, and you know, I have to agree with you. This is Max's race to lose. But you know what I'm thinking may happen? McLaren, if they can have the pace to beat Max and Red Bull fair and square, then we can have a very exciting championship. Because in McLaren, they have two very good drivers. But catching up to Max is one thing, passing him is another. You know, one thing I want to say, I have a lot of even more respect for Max now, both as a person and as a driver. He was recently asked to give his top five drivers. And, you know, in my humble little experience in talking to a lot of young drivers in the 15, 16 years, over 1,000 podcasts we have done, I've spoken to a lot of young drivers who either reached Formula One or did not, but are still very successful. Some became fairly well-known names in sports car racing, and I'm not going to take any names here. But the common thread I have noticed when you talk, and it was pretty obvious to me some years ago when I was talking to some kid who the previous year had raced against Lando Norris. Most of these drivers, you know, they don't say bad things about competition. But if a driver is dominating and has moved on, they really don't have nice things or positive things to say. They'll come up with, my team was not the best, or he was the chosen one, as was said by one of Lewis Hamilton's competitors. They were meant to succeed. So Max was asked to give his top five all-time drivers, great drivers. Now, everybody expects anybody and everybody to say, except for one journalist, some names like Fangio, Schumacher, Senna, okay? Max said your man's name, Machismo, and I was surprised. He said Lewis Hamilton. If Max Verstappen considers Lewis as one of the five top drivers of all time, I think we need to drop the word lucky with him, even though you need luck to win in anything. What say you?
Well, you do need luck in anything, and the planets have to align. You'll see that in the Japanese journalist interview. He points that out and eloquently. We cannot deny that Max is one big talented dude. So with the luck of the Honda coming together and one big talented dude, that's called le package.
Exactly. Very well said, Mr. Rogers. Okay, so speaking of Japanese journalists, let's take a flight to Tokyo, Narita, and have a chat with Zenta Otaki-san. We met at the Miami Grand Prix media room. Actually, we were sitting next to each other, and we also had a chat at Imola. My thanks to him for his time, and hope listeners enjoy this conversation. Okay, folks, today we have our new friend from Nihon, Mr. Zenta Otaki. Zenta-san, welcome to the crazy world of F1 Weekly. How are you, and how bright are the lights in Tokyo this evening?
Thank you for having me. Yes, such a beautiful night today. I could see right outside my window, I could see the Tokyo Skytree as well, and it's quite a beautiful evening. So
I'm sure it has quite a view and quite a big names there, like Honda, Toyota. Both of these are based in Tokyo, right?
Yes. Honda, I think, based in Aoyama as well, where I used to live nearby as well. So, yeah, it's quite a, yeah, it's like the motorsport culture is definitely around in Japan. So, yeah.
Very good. Now, we met at a football stadium, which is home to Fake Marina and American football. Let's hear how you got interested and involved in Formula One and motor racing.
Well, I mean, wow, where to begin? Given my accent, it may sound like I am quite a newcomer, like a newcoming fan, but yeah, that's not actually the case. Growing up, I've never been that big of a car person. I was always into where it was like trains, ships, planes, like, you know, into space. I was never really a car person, but I always was fascinated by racing and car racing specifically as well. I don't know why, but I think it all started out with, I think, you know, I have one of these books in my bookshelf. I still have it here. There was a picture of a Formula One car. I think it was a Ferrari. And I think that always like captured my imagination of like how like fast cars can go. And that laid dormant in my mind for like a while. And I think it was around 2012, 2013-ish when just out of the blue, I was like, I told my parents like, hey, you want to follow Formula One starting from 2014. And yeah, that's how we like as a family, that's how we started watching Formula One once again. My parents, both, you know, based out of Japan, they, after work, they come home and they would turn on the TV and they would watch Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost duke it out. This was back in the 80s and like the 90s. So yeah, it was quite a smooth transition for them. It was like we all got to enjoy watching Formula One again together as a family. And so ever since then, I've been following Formula One.
What was your first Formula One race, and what do you remember most from that race?
In terms of one that I attended in person, or
yes,
my first ever. That was the 2022 Japanese Grand Prix, and it's a long story. Like how I managed, I was very lucky. I was very, very lucky to get the opportunity to go to the Japanese Grand Prix in 2022. It was my first work. I started out as a paddock tour guide. And so I was, you know, giving tours for guests, F1 experience guests. And through the rain from Friday till Sunday, I would give, you know, we would walk up and down the paddock. And as that was going on, the championship decider was taking place as well. And that was my very first race was when Max Verstappen won his second title. And I was under the podium, and Yeah, if you look through the footage from back then, you could actually see me almost crying, like right behind Helmut Marko's shoulder as well. So it was quite a surreal experience, and one I haven't forgotten ever since.
Very good. Now, what publications do you represent when you travel to Formula One races?
At the moment, it's a singular publication. I know, like, there are many journalists who, represents, like, oh, I do this, I work with this place and this place. But at the moment, I work for one, which is called F1 Life, which is a Japanese online subscription-based publication. So what I do primarily is I take photos from the paddock, and I would like write captions or like some quippy like situate like lines of like what's going on at the paddock. And I also do interviews of drivers and record them, and I'd send them off to my boss. And also I sometimes do some translation work of some audio files into Japanese. So yeah, that's what I do primarily at the moment.
Now, you mentioned that you do these paddock tours. I have a question for you. Most of these people who come are like sort of, lack of a better word, VIPs. Most of them, I'm guessing, are not diehard racing fans. What is the most common question or sort of a thing you feel about when you take people on paddock tours?
One of the interesting things is there are people who do the VIPs as well. I occasionally get them, but primarily for me is both casual and very like hardcore fans. I get like a mixture of both. And like for the casual fans, one of the things that I noticed is they are very passionate, and they want to like absorb as much of the atmosphere and absorb as much information I have to provide them as possible. So I think in terms of questions, they are very avid learners. So everyone's like, what is this? What is that? Like down to like very specific equipment. And people want to learn a lot of the basic, sometimes some of the basic, what comes across as basic to us, but to them, it's very new. So I'm always won over by how passionate they are. And also, it's not just about drivers. It's also like wanting to branch out and learn, because this is a very, very difficult sport to learn. So I really appreciate how much they want to learn, like how deep in depth they want to learn these things. So, yeah.
Now, in your early days of interest in Formula One, what were the favorite drivers, if you had any, and what tracks you like? I would like to go and see a race at outside Japan.
That's the thing. Growing up, probably no surprise, given that I'm based out of Japan, grew up in Japan, and learned Formula One from the Japanese fandom. But Ayrton Senna, without a doubt, was like my... There was a time where it was like where he was the person to like learn about and just admire. But over time, I also learned to appreciate Alain Prost as well. He was portrayed as something of a villain, like the antagonist to Senna back in the day. But I grew to learn and appreciate how his philosophy of racing, like the four main drivers like of the era from the 1980s: Ayrton Senna, Nelson Piquet, Alain Prost, Nigel Mansell. Like those four, I studied them in depth and very much loved them as well. But those were the mainstream ones. Over time, as I studied Formula One, I grew to appreciate Mika Häkkinen, Olivier Panis as well. It was like people only seem to remember him for that 1996 Monaco win, which is a bit of a pity because he was a very fast and consistent driver, and people don't talk enough about his 1997 season in the beginning, how he was getting consistent podiums until that fateful crash. And I had a lot of appreciation. So I can kind of nerd out about a lot of these drivers. And as for tracks outside of Japan, Spa has always been, I mean, it sounds like cliche answers, but there's a reason why many people, listed as one of the best circuits as well. And I am yet to go. This season will be the first time I will visit Spa. So I look forward to that experience, but also Imola as well, which, of course, Japanese fans and many Formula One fans remember it as a place of tragedy. But, and I also did as well in the beginning as quite a place to be terrified of, or, but then I had an opportunity to drive it on the simulator and realized it's like, this is a track I really like. So, a level of appreciation, enthusiasm for wanting to go to the track and just walk the tongue, you know, this track as well. And I got to do that this year. So the first time. So, you know, it also did coincide with the 30 years since the passing of two great drivers. So I got to appreciate the history of what unfolded at that track and also of the track itself. So yeah, that was something that it was a bit of a dream of mine as a Formula One fan, and I got to live that. So yeah, that was quite an amazing experience.
Now, you know, going back to Ayrton Senna and Japanese fans, the love and respect they have for him still is very impressive. And I want to bring something that we touched in Miami. You know, I have never been able to do this as yet. It's just too much for me. But I read that when his death was announced on Japanese network, the newscaster broke down. Is that correct?
He did. Yep.
Wow.
Jun Imamiya. Yeah. The footage, if you're a fan of Formula One, a Japanese Formula One fan, and if you have access to YouTube, when we weren't alive back then, we get to watch the footage on YouTube, and it's difficult to describe in words. Like, it really goes to show how much Senna meant to Japanese Formula One fans. And yeah, level of passion, yeah, it's very difficult to describe in words. And also, I think one of the emotional lines was, I think he said, Jun Imamiya, who is, you know, it's been 4 years since we lost him. He was an amazing journalist, a Formula One journalist. And he said was, we've lost Senna, but, you know, Formula One goes on. And I think, you know, that's a line that has been immortalized in the fan base as well. And I think which has really motivated us to continue following the sport even after we no longer had Ayrton.
Moving on, history of Japanese success in Formula One go all the way back to the 1965 Mexican Grand Prix when Richie Ginther gave Honda their first victory. I want to ask you a question which a few very passionate racing fans have asked me over the years. With all the success for Honda since then, how come there has never been a Grand Prix winning Japanese driver?
That's the question that we Japanese fans ask ourselves a lot as well. Like many articles written about it, many like debates, many theories as well. Yeah, it's quite strange, isn't it? Because Japan has gained a lot of success in Formula One. Of course, as you mentioned, Honda as a engine supplier and also running their own teams. But also we've had Bridgestone as a tire supplier, you know, a lot of success with Ferrari as well. We've had Japanese team principals as recently as Ayao Komatsu. And like many prominent, there are many like Japanese mechanics, engineers who have attained success in Formula One. So why not drivers? And there are many ways to break this down. One way is to say, well, because there aren't enough Japanese Formula One drivers to begin with, getting to the point of entering Formula One already is difficult, because the way I see it, I've analyzed a lot, I've looked at it, and my conclusion is, of course, geographical distances from Japan to Europe, as well as language and cultural differences. So many Japanese drivers, young Japanese drivers, going over to Europe, and okay, so they have to like start up their career in single seaters. They would have a lot of difficulty. They would encounter a lot of like differences, which they may find hard to reconcile. That is definitely a problem for, you know, that is something they have to get used to. And it's the same way European drivers might feel when they come over to Japan for Super Formula or Super GT. Okay, so you've gone through that. It was like, and now you've made it to Formula One. But once you make it to Formula One, why no Japanese winners? A lot of times, just wrong place, wrong time, wrong team, wrong time. It's just, I think, you know, digging a little bit deep into Formula One history, we know there have been talented Japanese drivers. Takuma Sato, I mean, Kamui Kobayashi. Like, those two, I think, definitely stand out a lot. And also Ukyo Katayama as well, back in the 1990s. And yet, their speed, their talent, their racecraft, I think, sometimes, you know, they didn't have enough financial backing, or they couldn't make it to the top team, which, you know, would have easily guaranteed a win. And that's the thing that we still want after all these years, which we don't talk about it a lot. I mean, Japanese fans will always follow Formula One, regardless of whether a Japanese Grand Prix winner will emerge or not. But deep down, that is, I think, something all Japanese Formula One fans want to see one day.
Okay, now speaking of Super Formula and Japanese GT, both Honda and Toyota support these series very strongly. Do you see any young talent who may surface in Europe in the next year or two?
That is an interesting question, because when we look at a lot of the some of these drivers who race in both Super Formula and Super GT, is they may be familiar names for people who follow the lower categories, because they've been there before, like many names like Inoue Fukuzumi or Nobuharu Matsushita. Like, they've raced in Formula 2 before, and yeah, here we find them as well. So it's a reverse. It's not like they're about to go on to fight in races in Europe. No, they've come back and they're trying to carve a career for themselves in Japan. So at the moment, it's very difficult to find any drivers who would probably go on to race in Europe and who are currently racing in the Japanese racing scenes. The one exception I would say is Ayumu Iwasa. It's a name very familiar to people who have followed Formula 2 the past two or so years. He's now back in Japan racing in Super Formula in the hopes that he would perform well enough that he could be considered possibly for one of the Red Bull seats, but we shall see how that goes. I would say look out for Iwasa at the moment. He is quick, but also very intelligent, and that is a quality that, you know, he is very eloquent, he speaks well, and he is very mature thinking as well, and that has really hit me. As if I were a team owner, that is the kind of driver I would definitely want to have, and rarely do we get to see this level of intelligence and maturity from such a young driver, so he is definitely someone to look forward for in the future.
No, I totally agree with you. He impressed me a lot when he raced in Formula 2. Okay, the one who is racing right now, Senior Yuki Tsunoda, he is a very quick driver, and all he needs is the attitude of Ayumu Iwasa. Now, Yuki's antics make me call him Montoya of Motegi. What's his reputation with Japanese racing media and fans?
So, Yuki, the moment, if you want to talk about reputation, it is very high at the moment. He is received very well amongst racing fans and the media at the moment. Back when he made his debut in Formula One, back in 2021, not so much. His antics at the beginning, his repeated swearing, and also sometimes, you know, not being able to produce good enough results, has certainly like soured the way people and fans saw him. But the way he matured, especially from his third season onwards, like, that is, I think a lot of fans have like come around to appreciating him these days. So yeah, I think he has been able to grow rapidly so much, and fans, definitely Japanese fans, appreciate that.
No, there is no question. He is very quick, and he was very impressive in his first year in Formula 2. I think that was the year Mick Schumacher won the championship. I think, you know, if he calms down, and he will do very well, and I wish him well. Okay, now, there is another young Japanese racer, Juju Noda, daughter of Hideki Noda. She won a Formula 4 race in Denmark a few years ago at a young age. Where is she racing these days?
She is currently racing in Super Formula from TGM Grand Prix, and alongside like hard hitters like Iwasa and Matsushita, and the recent results, I think the race recently was in Autopolis, I believe, in Kyushu. I think she came in 20th, I believe, a lap down. So she's got a lot of work to do to be competitive at the moment. But I think she's also racing in the Boss GP series as well, parallel to Super Formula. Yeah, it is quite a challenge for her, but wish her the best. Yeah, let's see how she can grow from here.
Now, speaking of Autopolis, Japan has quite a few very good racing tracks.
Does any of these tracks come close to what Suzuka is?
That is a very tough one. Coming close to it, I would say that's a very tough one to answer because there are many unique tracks in Japan, but it's to put them on the same level of Suzuka might be very difficult, but that's in no way trying to put down all the other tracks. Like Sportsland Sugo, which is in the Tohoku region, is, I mean, I don't think Formula One fans will never hear about it because it's impossible for Formula One to compete there. It's very narrow. It's a small venue, but man, is it so much fun to watch, like, drivers go around that track. And also, there's, like, folklore about how there's a beast in the forests of Sugo that control the outcomes of the race. And, like, there have been many crazy races at Sugo. So, there's, like, unique stuff like that in Japan, in the Japanese racing scenes. Other than that, Fuji Speedway, we've had races in Formula One 2007, 2008, and okay, if you want to count like 1976 and 78, 77 as well. But yeah, I think given the track and given like what would be equivalent to Sector 3, it was a lot of twists and turns. We could have a lot of like side by side racing possible as well. So, in that sense, maybe that's Fuji might be some. It would probably not fill in the hole that Suzuka would probably leave if it were to drop off the calendar, but it would be a nice venue for competitive racing as well. So, yeah, I think Fuji would be a nice place as well.
You have lived in California for some years. Please tell us where you were based and what's your take on the Golden State?
So, I was born in San Diego, California, and I still go back there during the summer. Yeah, I used to go back there during the summers a lot, and the weather is amazing, and it's like the Mediterranean feeling almost, like the climate as well. People have been very kind and friendly to me, like as well. The Golden State in general, that's a tough one because primarily based out of San Diego, only occasionally have I gone to like other places, but like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Santa Cruz. Yeah, oh my gosh, man, do I want to go back to Santa Cruz. But it is quite a nice place, I would say. If we want to like get into the nitty gritty, the cost of living kind of it's not very friendly these days, but yeah, hopefully I could be back soon and just take everything in, because that's the place I would also call home as well. Japan has definitely raised me, you know, in the academically speaking, I would say. A lot of people have taught me, but California is where I would call home because I was surrounded by many experienced people with a lot of life experience, and they've been very patient with me, and they've, like, retired folk, you know, they took on the role of a grandfather to me, and they really raised me as well. So, yeah. That's something that I really look forward to meeting them again when I get back to California.
Well, you know, I've been to Santa Cruz many, many times. I was just there recently. A good friend of mine lives there. So if you're ever visiting Cruz Town, let me know. I'll come and see you.
Yeah.
Okay, now moving on. You, I think, heard me ask this question, which is my favorite question of this season. Will Lewis Hamilton win championship number 8 in a red car before Fernando Alonso wins championship number 3 in the green car? What say you?
Neither. Okay, all right. That's my honest reaction. Like, as when I heard that, I just instinctively, my answer would be probably neither if it's gonna happen. But if I... That's a bit mean, I know, but that's a tough question. If I were to choose one over the other, it's a close call, but I would say momentum is on the Prancing Horse's side. I would say Lewis would probably have a better chance. There's a better chance of Lewis winning his 8th title before Fernando. I think what Fred Vasseur is doing right now with the team, I mean, it's, if he's able to sign Adrian Newey, like, could you imagine, like, how insane the team is going to be? And at the moment, there's a part of me that really wants to see Fernando win his third title. Like, I've been following the sport long enough to understand, like, what he has gone through, especially during, I understand how he probably feels about his time at McLaren Honda, his second stint at McLaren. Like, he feels like he wasted his best years just at a back market team. And like, I understand what he has gone through, what he has seen. So for it to be, to pay off. And I also want to see in the Guinness Book of World Records, like the biggest gap between winning titles. That would be a fun one to witness in real time. It's like more than 20 years between winning titles in motorsport. That would be something insane to follow as well. So I wish Fernando could win his third title in Aston Martin. But I think we have seen an emerging pattern recently, haven't we, where anytime Aston Martin brings in an in-season update, it seems to really detrimentally affect the performance that happened last year, and we've seen that in the upgrades that they were brought in recently as well. So if they could iron that out, maybe we could see a very consistent Aston Martin that is able to progress and improve over time within the season. And when that happens, I think Fernando winning a third title might be more possible. Around this point last year, I would have been like, oh yeah, Fernando winning his third title. But at the moment, I think momentum is on Ferrari's side. And yeah, maybe Lewis Hamilton riding that prancing horse might have a better chance.
If Adrian Newey joins Ferrari, that will be Christian Horner's worst nightmare come true. But and speaking of Fernando, we call him Machismo on our podcast. Question is very important. Has he been forgiven by the Japanese motorsports media and fans for his famous comment during the Japanese Grand Prix at Suzuka some years ago?
It depends on who you ask. I try to read the internet comments under articles as much as possible so I could kind of like figure out what the people think about it these days. If you're like religiously for like a religious follower of Honda, there are people who would still not, people who have a very good memory, let's put it that way, who don't take it too kindly to Fernando's words back then. But also I think over time people have come to understand, it's like, hey, Honda wasn't perfect back then. They weren't able to produce good. Overpromising, a lot of overpromising and underdelivering took place. Well, you know, people have come to understand that as well. A lot of it probably has to do with the fact that Honda is currently dominating at the moment, and people feel comfortable enough to admit the faults that took place back then. But yeah, and also I think the thing that we have to take into account is many newcoming Japanese fans, and also fans all over the world, whenever they hear GP2 engine, I don't think most of them understand what GP2 even is. It's been that long ago. Yeah, it's like people wouldn't understand what GP2 is anymore. Like, so that really puts it into context. So like, I think people have moved on or have somewhat forgiven Fernando for what he has said. Besides, people also acknowledge how great of a driver Fernando is as well, and are excited to see the partnership of Honda and Fernando coming together once again, this time when Honda is well prepared. So there is something of a positive attitude towards looking to the future of the partnership between Fernando and Honda.
Okay, now, as mentioned to you in Miami, some members of F1 Weekly Familia, we are planning a trip to the Japanese Grand Prix next year. What will be your recommendation in terms of where to stay and where to watch the race from?
There's so much to do in Japan. So, of course, check your schedule. You know, when are you arriving? Yeah, how early you're arriving in Japan before the race might dictate how much exploring you'll get to do in Japan, but definitely don't miss Tokyo. There's so much to do. It's such a wide area, and it's wide area dense with stuff to do as well, and places to see. Don't like the Shibuya crossing or the Imperial Palace or Akihabara if you're like want to nerd out on like technology and tech gadgets. That is definitely a place you don't want to miss. But also there are many like the Sumida-gawa, which the Sumida River. There would probably be many locations alongside it. May cherry blossom locations as well. I'm just rambling right now because I have to like fire off so many locations. The fish market, the old fish market at Skiji as well. It's just so much to do. So if you were to like pull up a guidebook of Tokyo, and if you were just to blindfold yourself, just randomly flip through and just pick a random location in it, just plot a random trip, you would still be satisfied, because I think it's that much of a joy to just be in the city. There's so much to explore. And as for where to watch the race at Suzuka,
and where to stay going to Suzuka.
Where to stay? I think Shiroko Station would be, you know, near Shiroko would be a nice location, because that's one of the closer locations to Suzuka. But also, sometimes you can find some Formula One related people staying in hotels nearby as well. So you never know, you might have some unexpected sightings of certain Formula One drivers as well. As I did, as I got to witness, I'm not going to say who, but just walking through random restaurants, and I just happened to like catch one of the drivers having a meal there as well. So you never know. It would be fun to be around Shiroko as well.
Great, and we look forward to seeing you at the Japanese Grand Prix and enjoy some green tea mochi ice cream with you. Will you make time for little people?
Of course, and hopefully, given the season, we'll get to have some Sakura flavors ones as well. So those are very nice.
Thank you so much for your time. And when is your next race on the F1 schedule?
I will be in Canada, so I will be in Montreal in a week's time. So yeah,
oh,
I guess I'm going to pick up there, yeah.
And then you're doing.
It's going to be quite an expensive travel, but yeah, definitely. I always prefer to have at least one Japanese journalist present at each race, and I'm going to be that guy. So yeah, looking forward to. Yeah, no pressure. It's a lot of pressure, but I'll try to live up to it as much as possible.
And you mentioned you're doing Spa. You're doing Austria also, right?
Yes, I will be. Yeah.
Okay. I greatly appreciate your time. It's been fun meeting you at a couple of races this season, and hopefully our paths will cross again.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
Arigato.
Zenta, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Back to you, Nas.
And sir, doing a little fast forward, there is a good chance some members of the F1 Weekly familia, we were together at Melbourne Australian Grand Prix, and hopefully the whole group, entourage, will be at Suzuka, and we'll meet Zenta there also on his home ground. And he also does, as he says in the interview, Paddock Club Tour. So that's all very interesting. Okay, sir, back to US of A, IndyCar Racing. This was big news. Starting next year, they are moving from NBC, who I think did a very good job for them, to Fox Sports, who I think will also do a very good job. The big deal is all races will be on network TV, and IndyCars really, really needed this. This is the first time that in many years that all IndyCar races will be on network TV. You know, like this year, some are on US Network, some are on Peacock streaming. It's just hodgepodge here and there. So this is all network races. It's very good news for the series, and especially for the teams, as they now will have a wider audience to pitch to, but for potential sponsors. And if you look at NASCAR, I mean, every big American corporation is there. So it's about time that IndyCar, that NASCAR hears a giant sucking sound and sponsor going to IndyCar racing. Did the choice going to Fox Sports surprise you, sir?
I was very happy because, like you said, the hodgepodge of Peacock, USA, and NBC, so often I would miss a race because I simply didn't know where it was. Now, I understand I'm not very tech savvy, but it's very annoying when you go, what? Thank goodness. Network TV, that's what we want. That'll get your ratings up. I mean, sometimes I think they're so arrogant over at IndyCar, not realizing that, guys, it should be free for everybody everywhere.
I just have one request. I hope they don't start the Indy 500 with boogity, 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 let's go racing, boys, at the Brickyard. You don't expect that to be happening, do you?
Pretty soon.
Okay, sir. Now, my thanks to Miss Rafaela, for her latest contribution, Boys of Brazil, and we invite her to the Palatial Studios for her latest segment.
Hey, Hello, listeners. In today's half a report, I will talk about Grand Prix drivers from my home country, Brazil. Some of them raced in Formula One for many years and won many races, but unfortunately were unable to achieve the ultimate goal, the Formula One World Championship. This is part one of this report. Brazil has been represented in Grand Prix racing before the start of the Formula One Championship in 1950. Meet Francisco Chico Lange. He was one of the first Brazilian drivers to race in Europe. He drove a Maserati at the 1947 Barre Grand Prix. This race was broadcast on Brazilian radio, and the commentator was Emerson Fittipaldi's father. In 1948, he won the Barre Grand Prix driving a Ferrari. He took part in 6 Formula One championship races, making his debut at Monza in 1951, making him the first Brazilian to race in a Formula One championship event. His best finish was 4th in the 1956 Argentine Grand Prix, driving a Maserati. He later became manager of the Interlagos circuit and passed away in 1989 at the age of 81. That was Carlos Passi, taking his first and only F1 victory in the 1975 Brazilian Grand Prix, driving for Brabham. He had 5 other podium finishes. His first was with John Surtees' team when he finished 3rd in the 1973 Austrian Grand Prix. His only pole position came in the 1975 South African Grand Prix. Like Lange, Passi was also from São Paulo. His nickname was Moco, and he was a teammate to Carlos Reutemann at Brabham team. Passi was 1970 Forward Trust British Formula 3 champion. In 1973 Le Mans, he was 2nd in a Ferrari with Arturo Merzario. According to one of his competitors, based on Passi's wife's frequent shopping habits, in the paddock, she was known as Miss American Express. On March 18, 1977, Passi was killed in a private plane crash near São Paulo. Today, the Interlagos circuit is named in his honor and memory. Felipe Massa. He's another Paulista. Between 1999 and 2001, he won 3 championships. In 1999, he was Formula Chevrolet champion in Brazil. In 2000, he won the extremely competitive Formula Renault Euro Cup. And in 2001, was Euro Formula 3000 champion, winning 6 of the 8 races. He drove for Sauber, Ferrari, and Williams. At Ferrari, he won races against a very strong teammate by the name of Michael Schumacher. Massa's first victory was in the 2006 Turkish Grand Prix, and remaining 10 wins all came in the red car. He was world champion for 15 seconds in the dramatic season finale at Interlagos in 2008. This was his final Formula One victory. In all, he took part in 269 Grand Prix races and started from pole position 16 times. Massa is currently racing in the Brazilian Stock Car Championship and raced at Daytona 24 Hours race this year. Rubens Barrichello. His racing career was saved by a Brazilian businessman who offered to pay for his junior racing in return for 20% of future earnings. That was over 20 years ago, and to this day, Rubens is happily paying the businessman his 20% cut. After winning karting championships in Brazil, Rubinho landed in England in 1990 and hit the ground running, winning that year's Formula Opel Lotus Euro Series and the British Formula 3 in 1991 over DC. In 1994 at Imola, Rubinho was the first of 3 drivers to have a serious accident that weekend. He was the only lucky one. His first F1 victory came in the 2000 German Grand Prix for Ferrari. He took 8 other wins with the Italian team and was 2nd in the championship in 2002 and 2004. Not bad when the teammate is Michael Schumacher. Rubinho also scored 2 wins with Braun GP in 2009. He took part in 323 Grand Prix races, was on the podium 68 times, and started from pole position on 14 occasions. In life after Formula One, he raced IndyCars during the 2012 season and finished 11th at Indy. Today, back home in Brazil, he's still racing in the local stock car championship, where he won the championship in 2022 in a Toyota Corolla. Ricardo Zonta, he's the first driver on this list who is not from São Paulo. He's from my home city, Curitiba, in the state of Paraná. Expectations were high after championship success in the 1995 South African Formula 3, the 1997 Formula 3000 over Juan Pablo Montoya, in the 1998 World Sports Car Championship with Mercedes. This success did not follow him in Formula One. In 36 Grand Prix races, his best finish was 6th, 3 times in the 2000 season in Australia, USA, and Italy. Zonta is best remembered for the car in between Michael Schumacher and Mika Häkkinen at Spa in the 2000 Belgian Grand Prix. Zonta is currently 2nd in the Brazilian Stock Car Championship. His family owns Condor Supermarkets in Brazil. Cristiano da Mata. He's from Belo Horizonte. Cristiano inherited passion for motorsport from his papa, who won multiple Brazilian Stock Car Championships. Like most young Brazilian drivers, he traveled to England to find a way to Formula One. He was 8th in the 1995 British Formula 3 Championship. Only victory of that season was at Oldham Park. In 1996, he moved up to Formula 3000, scoring only 7 points. He was 9th in the championship. He then switched to racing on the other side of the Atlantic. Da Mata won the Indy Lights Championship in his second attempt in 1998. In 2002, he won IndyCar Championship in a Toyota-powered car, which got him into Formula One with the Japanese manufacturer. This experiment, like other IndyCar champions Alex Zanardi and Michael Andretti, did not work out. In 28 Grand Prix starts, Da Mata scored 13 points. Today he participates in family's clothing business, Da Mata Designs. Henrique Bernoldi. He was one of the first Red Bull Junior drivers to reach Formula One. Time and circumstances were not on his side. In 2001, DC and Ron Dennis were totally frustrated with Bernoldi at Monaco as he held up the McLaren driver for many laps. All his 28 races were with one team, Arrows. He did not score any points. Before racing in Formula One, Bernoldi won karting championships in Brazil and won the 1996 Renault Euro Cup. He finished on the podium in third place in both the 1997 and 1998 Macau Grand Prix. He was second to fellow Brazilian Mario Haberfeld in the 1998 British Formula 3. Today, Henrique is helping his son in his karting career in the US. Antonio Pisonia. In European racing circles, he was known as Jungle Boy as he came from Amazonia region in Brazil. After winning karting championship in Brazil in 1995, he moved to England and won the 1998 Formula Vauxhall Championship. The following year, he won Formula Renault UK. In 2000, he was British Formula 3 champion ahead of Thomas Schechter, Takuma Sato, and Cucumber. He made his Formula One debut in the 2003 season with Jaguar team. His best finish was 9th in Australia. Between 2004 and 2005, he took part in 9 races with Williams BMW team. In his first season, 2005, his best finish was 7th at Monza. In 20 Grand Prix starts, he scored 8 points. He's now helping his son in his karting career. Bruno Senna. A sentimental favorite for many, Bruno's racing career was put on hold after the passing of his uncle. He was a later starter in racing but had advice and guidance of his uncle's teammate and friend, Gerard Berger. In 2005, he raced in British Formula 3 with Raikkonen Robertson Racing. 3 podium finishes helped him to 10th place in the championship. In 2006, he won the first 3 races of the British Formula 3 championship. 2 additional wins placed him 3rd in the championship. In 2008, he won 2 races in GP2 and finished 2nd in the championship behind Giorgio Pantano. Bruno made his Grand Prix debut in 2010 with Spanish HRT team. Best finish was 14th in the South Korean Grand Prix. He switched to Renault team the following season. Only points finish was Monza in 9th. 2012 was his final season. He drove for Williams and finished 16th in the championship with 31 points. His best race result came at Sepang, where he finished 6th. In final analysis, 31 Brazilian drivers have raced in Formula One. They have scored a total of 101 victories. They have been on the podium 293 times and started from pole position 126 times. 65 of these were achieved by one driver, Senna. Hope you enjoyed this half a report. I'll be back in July with part 2 of this story. Thank you.
Rafa, thanks for the samba. Back to you, Nas.
Okay, sir. Finally, we come to Musical Mondial. One of the great singers from your country, Miss Françoise Hardy, passed away, and I'm sure you know a lot more about her, so I will let you say a few words before we play a very nice tune from her.
Well, she was very hot, hung around with everybody cool. She was a major model, a singer. She captured the hearts of the young people of Paris and loved Formula One. She was very good friends with François Sever. She's in the movie Grand Prix. She knew everybody because everybody wanted to know her. She was that cool. So really sad, and we will miss Françoise Hardy.
And I have to say, you know, there are several songs I like from her, and one of them we'll play right now. And she had a very nice voice, just like Dusty Springfield. So please listen to Miss Françoise Hardy, and thank you for listening.
Thank you. Good night.
De l'amour, le temps des copains et de l'aventure. Quand le temps va et vient, on ne pense à rien malgré ses blessures. Car le temps de l'amour, c'est long et c'est court.